Welcome back to Corn Belt Conversations. I'm your host, Troy Kazire. And today I'm joined by Gene Brokish. Gene is the Deputy Director for the Midwest Region with the American Farmland Trust. Gene, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Troy.
Gene, why don't we start with just kind of tell us a little bit about your background and kind of fill us in on what exactly your role is there with the American Farmland Trust and what your responsibilities are.
Yeah, you got it. So I grew up on a dairy farm in Southwest Wisconsin, actually, and really enjoyed the farm lifestyle. Agriculture, was very passionate about it. I grew up in a time and a place, though. I had two older brothers that were fighting over their place on the farm, so there really wasn't space for me. I guess as the fourth child and the second daughter, so I just felt like I wanted to be involved in agriculture through my career, and studied agronomy at UW River Falls, and then continued on for a master's degree in soil science at Purdue University, and have a really the pleasure and fortunate luck of working in agriculture my entire career. It has taken me to a couple different states, and I've always just kind of worked at that nexus or that combination where conservation and agriculture combine, thinking about how can we be more sustainable, how can we make sure that farmland is, that we're not eroding soil and we're preserving farmland for future generations. So I spent my career working in different aspects of that, and about 4.5 years ago joined the team at American Farmland Trust in the Midwest, where I'm responsible for a lot of our programs that look at soil health, water quality, providing technical information and financial resources for farmers to implement things like cover crops and reduce tillage, and working with partners who are working in that same space.
Yeah, and so that work with some you know, sustainable type agriculture practices kind of leads into our conversation today. I get a lot of questions about carbon markets, and that's really kind of what we wanted to hone in on. So, let's start off with just kind of a general overview. What exactly carbon markets are?
Well, I'll tell you, maybe one thing I didn't add about my background is the reason that I got into carbon markets was that we were getting a lot of questions from farmers as well. And we were also getting questions from representatives from carbon markets who were looking for us to help promote their product to farmers we were working with. So that's really how we got into it. And our role initially started and has continued to be as like an honest broker of in this space. I don't work or represent or advocate for any particular carbon market. It's more helping farmers understand and evaluate, and farm advisors too, you know, folks like agronomists or lending officers or CCAs, you know, what kind of questions, giving them information so that they can respond to the questions that their farmers are asking them. So that's really the space that we are playing in, and I think that's helpful to understand as we kind of get into kind of the conversation today. But to just start off, I think carbon markets in a nutshell are really, it's like any market, it's a transactional action where somebody is paying somebody else for a product. And in this case, a lot of corporations have set climate-related targets, and they are trying to meet those targets by improving their manufacturing, by improving their distribution, and reducing kind of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with those. And if they can't do that quickly enough or to the quantity enough within their own systems to meet their climate goals, they need to look outside. And one place that they're looking more and more is agriculture, because we know that a lot of practices can sequester carbon, can reduce greenhouse gases, so practices that farmers can implement. So that's really what the ag carbon market space is. It's monetizing some of those climate benefits that can be realized at the farm level.
And so I tend to oversimplify things, so correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially the upshot of this, right, if you have a and I'm just going to pull some numbers out of the air to make it easy. But, you know, just say you have a company, a corporation that is producing 100 tons of CO2 every year. They can be involved in one of these carbon market exchanges where if you have farmers involved in that exchange that adopt practices like cover crops, no-till, whatever the case may be, that theoretically could sequester 50 tons of carbon per year, then essentially that corporation will now be able to claim that they are producing a net 50 tons instead of 100, right?
Correct.
And then the farmers receive compensation for that. And then I would assume the corporation is able to stay within certain EPA regulations, probably some tax incentives involved there, I would guess.
Yes, that's correct in how it works. Right now, carbon markets are not regulated, or like all of this is voluntary in the United States, with the exception of California, which does have a cap and trade regulatory component that corporations need to follow. The rest of this space is all voluntary. So corporations are not required to do this. They are doing it because they're getting pressure from consumers to who are interested in more sustainably grown products. They're getting pressure from their stakeholders, and they've just met these they've stated these climate goals, and now they're getting pressure and scrutiny of like, how are they actually doing that versus just greenwashing and speaking, you know, making promises they can't keep. And so I think that's an important piece to understand, is that corporations aren't required to do this. This is voluntary, and they are making these commitments, and they're looking at a lot of different ways to help meet those goals. And one of those ways, again, as I mentioned, is working with farmers and buying credits from farmers who are reducing greenhouse gas or capturing some of that carbon dioxide and from the atmosphere.
Okay, and that's interesting. I did not realize. I thought the EPA did had set requirements, but it's only in California. That's interesting. Tell me a little bit more about how these exchanges work. I mean, obviously there's a lot of different companies out there, a lot of different exchanges out there. It's really still, I know I've heard the term Wild West used to describe this situation as it currently exists, but tell us a little bit about how these exchanges actually work.
That's a great question. And it depends a little bit on which type of market you're playing in. So there's, which we can get to in a moment here, but there's inset markets and offset markets. And there's a little bit of difference from the farmer perspective on how it works from them. But high level, just initially, a farmer learns about some sort of program and is willing and committed to make some sort of change on their landscape and their management. So in their field, they either need to implement a new conservation practice, or they need to maybe tweak an existing practice they're doing to capture more carbon. So one example is maybe if they're conventional tilling right now, and they switch to no-till or strip-till, that is a practice that allows the soil to capture more organic matter and more carbon, and therefore is taking reducing carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas, right? And so the farmer needs to make some sort of change like that. Another change is implementing cover crops in their rotation. Or kind of the third most common change would be looking at nutrient management and really dialing in your nitrogen management so that you are minimizing nitrous oxide, which is a really potent greenhouse gas. Those are the three kind of common practices for row crops. If you're a livestock operation, you could be looking at manure management and like how you're storing the manure, things like that, because manure is often associated with methane, which is another greenhouse gas. So essentially step one is for the farmer to evaluate and identify some sort of change they're willing to make, and then engaging with either a corporation directly or like a broker who is working on behalf of the corporation and signs a contract or some sort of enrollment form that outlines what practices they're willing to do, how long, what the payment terms are, et cetera. And so it's like any other contract. Really encourage farmers to review the details and read it closely. And if you have an attorney to help even read through it and make sure that your interests are protected. So the farmer signs that contract, and then they, through the next growing season or the next 3 growing seasons or 10 growing seasons or however long the contract specifies, they agree to implement that practice and continue making that change to help build that carbon in the soil and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And then on an annual basis, the company or whoever the contract holder is does some sort of verification process that could include looking at a farmer's records. It could include taking soil samples or using remote sensing to observe what's happening in the field. And then the farmer gets paid based on how many carbon credits are generated through that practice.
And so now you've mentioned several times it requires adopting a new practice. And I know that's one of the criticisms that you do hear about a lot of these different programs, is that the guy who has been doing, say, no-till and cover crops for years is not able to participate in a lot of these programs. So there's been a criticism there. What's the status of that? Have there been some new programs come along that allows those types of farmers to participate, or what's your message around that?
That's a great question. And the term that's often associated with that is called additionality. It's a kind of a requirement or a, I guess requirement is the right word. Some programs require the practice to be brand new because it needs to meet some sort of additionality criteria. And the thinking behind it is valid in my mind. We are trying to address, or the corporations are trying to reduce greenhouse gas production, right? And so if we think on a global scale, if we're paying somebody to just keep doing what they're already doing, we're not actually decreasing the amount of greenhouse gas that's being produced. So corporations are saying, to really, in order for us to claim this credit or to claim this progress, we need to actually affect some sort of change with our dollars. And that's why they're requiring that additionality piece. So you're absolutely right. Farmers who are already doing, no-till and already doing cover crops will have a much harder time meeting that additionality threshold. My message, I get that that's really frustrating to farmers. And I would just kind of maybe fall back on the explanation that these are all voluntary, and corporations are really driving these, and it's not necessarily designed by or for farmers. So that may be one thing to just keep in mind. yeah. And then I think if someone really, really wants to participate in a carbon market, I would challenge them to think about how to dial in the practices they're doing. So one example is maybe you're doing cover crops before soybeans, but then you're doing, not doing cover crops before corn, which is the common kind of cover crop rotation in the Midwest. You could look at doing a cover crop before corn as well. So you did cover crops every year. That would meet the additionality criteria. Another example could be that you would do a multi-species cover crop, because the more diverse your cover crops are, the more potential you have for capturing carbon. And then the third kind of management tweak that could be in theory done if you're already an adopter of cover crops is that, instead of terminating it, the kind of the easy thing is to terminate it at least 2 or 3 weeks before you plant. Well, if you wanted to let your cover crop grow longer in the spring, and some farmers are experimenting with planting green, so the longer you let those cover crops grow, the more carbon that they capture. So there's ways that you could dial in your management of these practices and still meet that additionality criteria. But I get that's a lot of work and effort, and it might be a relatively small return on investment for the farmer. So I don't want to be like overpromise and say, oh, it's easy to meet that additionality criteria, because it does take some management and consideration there from the farmer perspective.
Oh, that's great insight. I appreciate it. So now you mentioned the difference between what they call inset markets versus what they call offset markets. Can you kind of go into that and maybe explain the difference there?
Sure. So this is a little bit related to the type of emissions the corporations are trying to address. So you might have also heard of scope 1 and scope 3 emissions. And the two different types of markets are tackling those two different scopes. So basically an offset market is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from an activity in one location that's sold as a credit to offset somewhere else. This would be an example of, say, Microsoft is a corporation. They have a facility that they're heating and cooling, and they're emitting carbon dioxide through that, and that's called their scope 1 emissions. And they are then purchasing credits through the offset program from a farmer in Illinois. Offset credits are, the buyers are typically outside of the agriculture sector, and it often requires some sort of broker or middleman to connect the farmer to the buyer. The inset program is generally a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions within a corporation's supply chain. So this is often being driven by agriculture entities. So folks like ADM is buying grain from the farmer, and then they're selling that, and they are trying to meet targets for the products that they're buying and selling. So they are incentivizing farmers that are within their supply chain and providing payments to farmers, maybe when they deliver grain to the elevator. And those are ADM's scope 3 emissions. So I can just, it's a lot to unpack there. We can answer questions too. But just again, generally offset market, the buyer is outside of the ag industry. Inset market, the buyer is typically within the ag industry.
But then they both essentially have the same requirements. The farmer has to adopt a practice that is sequestering carbon, helping that whoever the buyer is be able to reduce their carbon footprint.
Yes. Correct? Yeah. There's a few. Sometimes the record keeping is more onerous. Generally, I would say offset programs are more environmentally rigorous, and they're often more paperwork involved. There's often a higher additionality threshold for the offset markets. For inset programs, sometimes the additionality, there's a lot more flexibility on additionality because going back to my example of ADM, for example, ADM may be just interested in sourcing green grain. You know, by green, I mean just carbon, low intensity carbon scores grown in sustainable practices. And they may not care if you have been using those practices for a long time. They're interested in understanding what their accounting system is for the grain that they buy and sell. So from a farmer perspective, inset markets or inset programs tend to be a little bit easier to qualify for. I think from a farmer's perspective, they're more tangible and relatable because when you deliver your grain to the elevator and you get a few extra cents per bushel on your soybeans, you know, it makes sense. Like you're being rewarded for the activity that you implemented in the field. And then also inset contracts tend to be shorter. So if I don't like to recommend, and my job is not to recommend to a farmer this program is best for you and this program doesn't make sense for you. But I do feel comfortable in saying from a farmer's perspective, I feel like inset programs make more sense, especially if you're not quite sure you're in it for the long haul, or you do have the ability to, or you have a relationship with a direct relationship with a buyer. So like if you're already selling to ADM, it might make a lot of sense for you to sign up for ADM's inset program and realize the benefits for some of the practices that you're doing on the farm.
So, you know, obviously any kind of a program like this or a contract like this is going to carry, you know, pros and cons, or if not cons, risks or whatever. Let's kind of start on the plus side. Obviously the farmer's receiving a payment, receiving compensation. So what, you know, I mean, why do you recommend farmers participate in these? What's the upside for them?
So I guess I want to put a disclaimer in there that I don't necessarily think these markets are good for every farmer out there. You know, I think that for some farmers it makes a lot of sense, and for some farmers it doesn't. So I think that's the first kind of consideration, is just knowing which questions to ask to help you understand, is this good for me or not? And part of that does go into the risk, or what is the requirement of the farmer? So some of the requirements, or some of the things that might make it less beneficial to the farmer, include record keeping. Some of the programs have a pretty high record keeping requirement, and for farmers that may not be automating their data, it might be really hard to get the right data. And it might be to the point where if you don't have enough quality data, then the amount of money you get paid is actually lower. And so sometimes it's just a return on investment. If you're getting, you know, $10 or $15 an acre without doing a lot of extra work, because you have the records and you already committed to doing this practice and you have an opportunity, you know, it makes sense for your operation long-term, that $15 an acre is kind of gravy on top, and it just makes sense for you to participate in this market. If you are not fully committed to the practices like cover crops and reduced tillage or nitrogen management, you don't have the capacity to get the records in order, and you're not sure, like also if you're leasing land and you're not sure you can meet that 10-year requirement, you know, then that's more of a potential risk for you. Or that $15 an acre may not offset the amount of time it takes for you to make those management changes and to track down those record details. So it's really just weighing that on a farm level, like what is their commitment and what do they need for this to make sense to them? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I appreciate it. So if just thinking about scenarios, and obviously I'm sure all contracts are different, it's tough to start answering specific scenario type questions, but just thinking of a situation, say a farmer's involved in one of these contracts, you know, he's agreed to do no-till or cover crops, say, and a couple of years into it, a field gets, you know, flooded badly, and he's unable to do a cover crop, or maybe he has to go in, do some tillage to open that back up again, you know, after a major flooding event, just something like that. What's the risk there? Is he just not going to receive that payment? Do they have to buy those credits back? What's the risk there in a situation like that?
Those are fantastic questions for farmers to ask the representatives as they're talking and evaluating different programs. Generally, it varies a little bit by programs, but my observation of the programs is that a lot of them have kind of a safeguard in there where the farmer won't be penalized for that. They may not receive a payment for that year if, for whatever reason, weather or like you mentioned, you know, there's a flood and you just can't make it happen, or there's a drought and your cover crops don't grow, they won't be penalized. Like they don't have to pay money back, but they may not receive the payment for that year because they may not be producing the carbon that year, right? A lot of markets have, particularly the offset markets, have what are called buffer pools, which are sort of like savings accounts that they are putting aside for exactly that purpose. They may be working with 100 farmers, and collectively those 100 farmers are generating 1,000 credits. Just I'm doing simple math, right?
Sure.
They might, as the broker, as and so like an example of a company that's working as a broker, and again, I'm not advocating for any particular market, but Indigo Ag often serves as that broker. They are combining those 1,000 credits from the farmers, and then they're only selling, you know, 900 of them to Microsoft because they're keeping 100 in their savings account for exactly that event, because they need to have that in available when the corporation says, hey, we need to buy another 100 credits or we need to buy another 1,000 credits this year. They can pull from that buffer pool.
Okay, that's interesting. So how, you know, when we talk about verification, what are some of the methods? I know you mentioned obviously record keeping. Do they do, you know, spot inspections of fields? How is this typically verified?
So some programs are using, or it's very common to use remote sensing right now. Satellite imagery is shockingly personal if you have access to it. So I think a lot of companies, as part of the enrollment process, you need to provide your field boundaries and you'll need to say what you're planning to do in that field. And then they can use remote sensing to make observations in terms of, you know, again, for cover crops, was there something green growing there over the winter? For tillage, they can look and see what kind of field operations were done. They also are asking farmers to provide planting dates, fertilizer dates and application rates. They are asking farmers to share yield data to help estimate like kind of the intensity of each bushel of corn produced, that kind of thing. Some programs do soil sampling, have soil sampling requirements, which would be kind of that, or they might be doing that spot check like you talked about. You know, they might, in addition to remote sensing, they might actually be doing some follow-up in person or asking farmers to take pictures to verify what happened in the field. The offset markets also have kind of a registry component to it. So particularly to help those corporations to help bring clarity and transparency to the corporate claims, they are registering those credits they're just called registries. So they're actually kind of neutral accounting or third-party accounting companies that are estimating or documenting how many carbon credits were generated, how many carbon credits did Microsoft buy or sell over the course of the contract lifespan. So that's, again, where that additional scrutiny comes in, because the verification process for offset markets, the farmer may have more data that they need to provide in order to really benefit from that program.
So when you've got a farmer that's been presented with a contract, you recommend they have an attorney look at it, or are there organizations that help provide advice and look at some of those contracts, or what's your message there to a farmer that's been presented with an opportunity?
Absolutely. My recommendation is to read the contract themselves. I mean, I'm guilty of this too, right? How many contracts are we presented with and we don't read all the fine print, we just sign it. So having farmers read the contract, if they have an attorney, That's the best case. Absolutely. Have someone who is representing your interests read it and help you understand it. If you don't have an attorney, I think having the farmer read the document and, you know, highlighting terms that they don't understand, and then reaching out to maybe agronomists or maybe somebody who they feel could help navigate that. It's not really a service that we provide, but we have advocated for more transparency in contract language. And there's also a resource, and I can make sure you get the link to this, Troy. There's a resource produced out of Minnesota that was sort of like a farmer's guide to carbon market contracts, which I think would be a fantastic resource for people to look through. I think it defines some of the common terms and helps farmers understand what the implication of those different terms are from their perspective.
No, that's great information. I appreciate it. And I know you did give me a couple of links here to more resources and information. And I will definitely put those in the notes here and in description for this episode. What else, Gene? What haven't we covered yet that you want to make sure we get across to the folks listening today?
Yeah, two things. I think one is to just kind of shout out to the resources that are going to be shared with the notes. One is a document developed by the Illinois Sustainable Ag Partnership, which provides pretty detailed comparisons of 15 different markets that are available for Illinois farmers, but the same markets are likely available in Indiana or Iowa or Missouri or whatever, anywhere there's kind of that row crop agriculture happening. Our goal with that was really to provide that side-by-side comparison for farmers so that they could look at what the contract terms are. They could look at what the additionality requirement was. They could look at what kind of pricing and practices were included there. So really encourage people to check that out. We worked and got that information directly from the market representatives. We developed it almost a year ago now, and things are moving. So while that was current in June of 2023 when we published that, always recommend people to just reach out and have conversations with market representatives to get the most up-to-date information. And the other piece that we haven't really touched on yet is like what actual dollars and cents farmers could get from this. And that's one thing that we've tried to kind of outline as well in that document developed by the Illinois Sustainable Ag Partnership, but also another document developed by American Farmland Trust, where we kind of said what the average price from a farmer perspective might be. And right now, the price of a carbon market is about $20 to $30 per credit. And farmers in Illinois, or kind of the average farmer in the average corn and soybean system, could maybe generate a credit per acre. And that is with doing like maybe no-till and cover crops both. So I just feel it's important for farmers to kind of have realistic expectations about what they might be paid as well. You're looking at maybe somewhere between $15 and $20 an acre is what farmers would actually receive by doing those practices. Which is just helpful context. And I think it's especially helpful when you think about it. For many farmers, that's not enough. If it's going to require new equipment, and it's going to require, you know, the seed cost of cover crops, it's going to require time for you to do that. I get that that may not pencil out for most farmers. But one thing that's a possibility is to combine the carbon payment with payments that are available through traditional USDA cost share programs. So programs like EQIP, which is paying more like $60 an acre for cover crops. So if you could actually stack your cover crop payment from through EQIP with your carbon market payment, then you're looking at like $75 an acre, which suddenly makes a lot more sense to farmers. So just encourage farmers to think about lots of different options or all the options for them if they're thinking about making some sort of management change that would include, you know, new practices for them. And again, those two resources kind of touch on some of those different approaches that farmers can think about.
No, that's great information. I appreciate that. You know, that's not really an angle that I'm sure a lot of guys think about, is that there could be possibly other government programs they could stack with this to make it pencil a little bit better. And then, of course, there's the intangibles that go along with it when you're talking about soil health and things like that. It's a little bit tougher to put a dollar amount on those, but in some cases, I'm sure those can definitely add up as well.
Yeah, that's a great point too, and that's one thing I always try to remind farmers of. You do get a lot of on-farm benefits from a productivity, from a nutrient cycling, from an erosion control of these practices as well. There's a reason that we've been promoting these practices for a long time. They do benefit the soil, they do benefit water quality, and farmers who have experience and commitment to soil health really will tell you that they see a lot of benefits in their pocketbooks too. They could maybe reduce their inputs, see more consistent yields and drought tolerance and stuff like that. So I think it's also just helpful to kind of get back to the foundation. A lot of these carbon markets and incentives are based on good soil management, and I like to kind of bring farmers back to that in the end too, of like good soil management. Your soil is your best asset on your farm. So whether the carbon markets, whether $15 an acre is lucrative enough for you or not, I don't know. But if you look at the whole picture and you think about the long-term benefits to your farm and your goals of your farm for the future, passing on to the next generation in better shape. These practices make a lot of sense from that perspective, and there's a lot of resources out there to help farmers implement practices. And for farmers who are thinking about making a change anyway, really encourage them to look at carbon markets as a way to help offset some of the cost and look at those other cost share programs to help, just help with that transition period. I think there's a lot of value in that there.
Absolutely. Well, great information, Jean. I really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us today and share your insight.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Jean Brokish, Deputy Director for the Midwest region of the American Farmland Trust. Jean, thanks again for joining, and thanks to everyone for listening. And we will see you next time on the next Corn Belt Conversation. Thank you.